Welcome to Truth Talk. It's a lovely day today here in DFW. Today we're going to talk about the Islam effect. Our guests today are Ms. Leah Farish and Aman Mir Hatut. Ms. Farish is a graduate of Duke University with a master's degree from Vanderbilt and her law degree from Baylor University. She's an award-winning attorney who has represented Muslim clients in civil rights matters. She has published 3 books and several articles, such as Impunity Watch and the Journal of Religion and Society. Ms. Farish, we'd like to take a moment to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, ma'am. Can you explain a little bit to our listeners who are not familiar with your work, a little bit more in detail about your career and your efforts?
Yeah, sure. I've been interested for over 25 years in the area and practiced in the area of the First Amendment, and that involves two particular subgroups, First Amendment free speech issues and religion issues. And that is two subparts: establishment of religion, the issue of government support or entanglement with religion, and government protection of the free exercise of religion. I've represented Muslim clients in a variety of cases and disputes, and of course people of other faiths or no faith, in protecting their freedoms under the Constitution and their equal rights. So I've represented abortion clinic protesters, Bible clubs in, public schools. I've represented street preachers and advised school administrators and other officials on how to accommodate religion, employers, employment issues that concern religion. And so that's the kind of thing that I've done most of my career.
Okay, sounds good. Hopefully later in the hour we'll have Iman Mir Hatut joining us. But
sure.
To start off, what I want to touch base on is here in the country, here in the United States, it seems to be, for lack of better words, the ignorance and fear and hatred of Islam. Because you seem to, in spite of what has happened this past week, over in Boston and such, it seems to me some of the comments that you hear in the national media, whether it be radio, television, internet, seems to be kind of a hatred or a dislike towards the Islamic culture. I've heard statements made such as the Fox News show with certain people on there from the Five stating that the United States, when it comes to immigration, should not allow any Muslims to come into this country until they are, I guess, actually checked out, that to something to that effect. I don't know if you're familiar with the statement that was made. But
no,
it seems, it seems as though the point I'm getting to is that we can have many law-abiding Muslim Americans in this country sometimes seem to face discrimination and charges that they're not real Americans simply because of their religion. And it seems that there is, in fact, kind of a rising tide of religious discrimination in the United States and in its communities, such as workplaces and schools. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I have certainly talked to some Muslims who have wondered if they were being discriminated against, and we've been able usually to address their concern and found out that there was a bureaucratic problem with what was going on rather than some kind of profiling. But I don't know what was said on the Five. They're pretty lively, unrestrained, colorful folks that
yes, they are.
Use rather colorful language on the program for, effect. But
right.
I have been studying the Pew Forum survey, which is a respected research organization that has come out with their figures from 2011, their most recent study of Muslims in this country, who are indicating a pretty high level of satisfaction with being here. Only about half of them say that most of their close friends are Muslims, and only 7% say that all their close friends are Muslims. There's a trend compared to 2007 in the confidence level among Muslim Americans in the measures that the U.S. is taking against terrorism. It's a growing comfort level with feeling that these are legitimate measures that are being taken. It hasn't reached a majority quite yet among Muslims, but they too are being inconvenienced. It's a big nuisance to deal with the kind of restraints and restrictions we've been forced into to fight terrorism, but I think that the trend is positive, Muslim Americans were asked, have Muslim leaders done as much as they should to speak out against extremists? And 48% of American Muslims said they have not done enough. So almost half of American Muslims feel like their leaders are not doing their part to address Muslim extremism. 28% of American Muslims reported having been looked at with suspicion. Now that's unfortunate. That's, you know, a little over a fourth of all American Muslims self-reporting, of course. Mm-hmm. That's not proof that it happened, but they feel that someone looked at them suspiciously at some time. I do think that if you asked American African Americans, have they ever been looked at with suspicion, it could be twice that. I don't know. But certainly from my work as a civil rights attorney, I would say that Muslim Americans are not out of line in saying that. I think I've been looked at with suspicion, and I'm not African American, I'm not Muslim. But, right. You know, we do have these experiences sometimes. 22% of American Muslims reported having been called an offensive name or having heard Muslims called by an offensive name in their opinion. This is subjective, and that's unfortunate, but we live in a society where there's lively debate. People are free to say offensive things for the most part, and the First Amendment permits a rather raucous society. And so the expectation has to be that you're probably not going to go through your entire life without ever hearing a group that you identify yourself with cast in disparaging terms.
Right.
This is part of life. It should be the expectation in America that we have to have a little bit of a thick skin. Now, I'm for civility. And I think that people should be respectful and kind to each other, and not just minimally. I think people should love each other. But that's not the standard that's imposed on people by the First Amendment, and not the expectation that we should have when we walk out our front door or when we surf the Internet. And certainly you as a talk show host know, and you value lively debate, and I frankly salute you and anybody that tries to expose us Americans to each other in a variety of lights and try to help us be spontaneous with each other, hear each other out, stick around to get past the initial sting of a surprising or hurtful statement, to see what's behind that and see if we can come to understand each other and heal each other.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for that. I want to share with you real quickly about the statement that one of the co-hosts made, and we can respond afterwards. But he made the statement in summation saying that he felt that the United States should stop Muslim students from coming to this country. I believe the statement was made, and I quote, they recruit people from poor areas and turn them into terrorists. He says that we have to really consider what we have, that we're going to have to cut off Muslim students from coming to this country for some period of time so that we can at least absorb what we've got. And we have to decide whether some of the people here should be sent back home or sent to prison. End quote. That's from one of the co-hosts, who I won't name, from the Five. Now, coming from my culture, in response to some of that, that's to me, that's discrimination. Because the same was said about African Americans years ago, and probably still in this day, very subtle, like, go back home or maybe send them back to Africa and so on and so forth. It's within those same, it's within the same scope. Do you agree?
Well, I think that that kind of statement is, you know, it's obviously a reactive statement to events that have been extremely painful and horrifying. It mustn't shock people that people hurt and say hurtful things when they are hurt, whether that deserved to be on national television, whether it's a serious policy statement, I think is highly doubtful. It's unfortunate that in our 24/7 news cycle, people have a chance to give a voice to things that, if they could stop and consider a little bit, maybe they would give a more measured response, more generous response. But if the person is saying, maybe we need to reexamine our immigration policy, you know, I think that we've done a rather spectacular job of welcoming a diverse number of people into this country without incident. And it may be true that our student immigration policy hasn't had proper oversight. I do not know. I do not know what kind of oversight that specific category in immigration has, whether that's been well managed. But young people are, you know, just by definition, they're inexperienced, they're immature, they're impulsive, they're subject to extreme ideas, both bad, you know, and quite idealistic and noble. And I think it's a function. It may be there. We have found that there is a high demographic participation among males 15 to 25 in hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that in terrorism. And this is, you know, the young adult is who comes over as a student. So you may have a little bit higher proportion of students who are involved in various kinds of extremism, terrorism, all kinds of mischief. But you're going to have that percentage in that age group. And when you have foreign students, they're going to be in that age group.
Okay. Okay. But you mentioned something. You said that the response was, you know, people say things and react to certain things from hurt, in fact, you know, due to certain events that have occurred. Well, in some of our research, we found from a journalist by the name of Mr. Stephen Walt some evidence as far as the United States relations with, say, Islamic countries. And I just want to share this a little bit. And I know these numbers that I'm going to read does not reflect in totality everything. I mean, they're not accurate. I know these numbers are more than what we're going to share today. But going back to Desert Storm back in 1991, the United States suffered from 293 total deaths, where Muslim fatalities were 56,000 military, but there were 3,500 civilian deaths. And the UN sanctions on Iraq from 1992 to 2002, there were at least 100,000 excess deaths. And Mogadishu in 1993, there were 315 Somalia militia that died, 18 military for the United States. And in Afghanistan, from 2001 to present, we have between 12 to 32,000 civilians, Islamic civilians. Those numbers may be higher now, and 920 United States fatalities in the military. That number may be higher.
As of this morning, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I heard on the radio today.
Okay.
Yeah,
I could.
Go ahead.
I could go on a little bit with other numbers, but the last one I'm going to share is Iraqi freedom. From 2003 to the present, there have been 4,366 military and 1,400 contractors on the United States side, and there have been 16,000, the total during the invasion, and at least 100,000 in excess deaths during the occupation for Islam. Those numbers are over 200,000, I mean, well over 200,000 deaths for Muslim fatalities. So I think that it's fair to say that their reaction to the United States is based because they've been hurt, because they've been wronged. And in some ways, it seems as though the United States will not acknowledge the killing of innocents, if you will, in Islamic countries, and it's almost as if they're Islamic, they deserve to die. It's something that seems to be the message that they receive from the United States.
Are those American statistics?
American statistic? No, those that over 200,000.
No, I mean, did you get those statistics from a United States source?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, then the U.S. is acknowledging those deaths. They are taking responsibility and acknowledging it. They're acknowledging it. You got that information from the United States.
Yeah, but
they're
we have
open
to
about
need
it.
To get that. It was very, you know, it's kept, how would you say, on a low scale. It's not brought into public light on national media, national TV.
Where did you get it? You got it from media in the United States. It's not a secret. It's open, and it's government statistics, I imagine. We try to be transparent.
Okay.
That's a function of our sense of what our government owes us, and mm-hmm. of the United States deaths, the casualties on the United States side, which you can't say U.S. versus Muslim. Muslims are part of the United States. They've died in these maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
These are Muslim deaths also. And, there's a variety of people on both sides, although overall in these operations, Muslims, of course, have disproportionately died in their own countries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hate the fact that people die in war. I hate it. That has touched my family. That it's a horrible thing. So it's a horrible thing to have to kill, too. This is something
right.
that is not pleasing to anybody. But we should not make a distinction, Muslims on one side, Americans on the other. Muslims are Americans. They're serving in the military honorably, and they die, too. And they are trying to prosecute missions that they embrace because we have a volunteer military, and you can ask them why they think it's justifiable to go out and kill Muslims. But, we have done these things based on considerations that are based on our national interests, and every nation is permitted to make those decisions. I think it shows the efficiency of the American military that they try to avoid their own casualties. And I'm glad that we do. I'm sorry that we've had to be involved in these operations. But I think that to say Muslim Americans feel somehow bitter or disenfranchised because of the fact that the U.S. has successfully prosecuted some military operations in predominantly Muslim countries is an issue for them to take up with the military. And I do find the Pew statistics do say that Muslim Americans tend to be about 65% are Democrat and about high 20s are Republican. And so I think the Democrats have been more critical of military operations overseas, and that might be, you know, a reflection of that. But I don't find that Muslims in this country are particularly outspoken against military problems. Now, if you're saying that Muslims overseas don't like to be killed, I can certainly agree with you. And it can make them mad for family members and, to be killed, homes to be destroyed. That's a terrible hit that we take on our hand of friendship that we try to extend. Yes,
right.
Yes, that is problematic for international goodwill.
Okay.
Absolutely. But it's not a civil rights question for me to address, you know.
Okay.
I think it will be interesting to see if President Obama, who has very high satisfaction rates with Muslim Americans, about 75%, if changes course, particularly in Afghanistan. That Muslims may be watching that with interest, but they strongly approve of what he's doing. And I think it's 56% of Muslims in the U.S. who feel that the U.S. is on the right track and are satisfied with our policies overall, which is a higher degree of satisfaction than the general public.
Right. That's true. That's true. But the point I was trying to allude to when I read those numbers was that on international ground, that the hostility that the Muslim countries take towards the United, the stance they take towards the U.S. is, and you know, when Americans die, the whole country reacts.
Okay,
you know, and they don't like
it. Some of those are Muslims. I just don't accept the distinction between they're Americans on one side and Muslims on another. You're going to have to frame those categories a little bit differently.
The categories, well, for example, Afghanistan. Okay, if you look at Afghanistan, you look at Iraq. Okay, those are Muslim countries. I know you agree with that.
I would say that.
Now, the point that I'm saying is when those countries have issues with the United States, it is based on certain things that the United States has done to a degree. I know it goes deeper than that, but at the same time, there has been reports that have not. The thing that I'm saying is that certain information may be out there for us to receive and retrieve to get, but it's not done by, for example, the government putting this information out there. Some of the information that is put out there, fact-based, is done by independent journalists searching and seeking for the truth. To, you know, because certain information was not given to them, such as when the government hires contractors to go in there and do the job that the military is doing, and these contractors kill innocents, the public doesn't know about that all the time, unless some independent reporter has made headlines by what they've exposed.
Well, we have embedded reporters. We've had embedded reporters for how long? 20 years now?
Mm-hmm.
We have embedded civil rights attorneys that travel with our military, that advise and supervise the legality of everything we're doing. This is unprecedented in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. So you don't believe that, or I'm just asking you this question, do you not think that the U.S. has done some grave wrongs to some of those Islamic countries from contractors that the U.S. hired killing innocent people?
When anyone, you know, kills somebody through negligence or malice outside of their of the military operation that has to be conducted, which is, you know, conducted by the commander-in-chief of the United States. If they take it upon themselves to use excessive force and torture, all those kinds of things. Yes, that's a shame upon the United States to do that. And we court-martial those people. We remove them from the field. We, you know, discipline them. We shame them every way we can think of. When it comes to light, and yes, people sometimes cover up things, that is a corollary to doing the bad thing initially. Usually if someone will do something cruel, they'll do something dishonest to cover it up.
Exactly.
And that's pitiful. It makes me very, very sad. Of course, it creates indignation among the victims of that kind of thing. Absolutely. It's counterproductive. And we try and we train and train and train our men and women not to do those kinds of things, but you'll have deviations from the training, and you may have misguided policies. I know there are, you know, people overseas who are angry about the fact that we still have Gitmo. President Obama promised he would close it. He's been in office 6 years, and it's still open. You know, I can understand frustration with broken promises and political posturing. That's unfortunate.
Right.
To me, the level of satisfaction with President Obama among Muslim Americans is a mystery. But there it is.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, but I want to make sure I clarify something. I don't want to make it sound as though I'm saying that certain acts that have been done towards the United States, terrorist-wise, are justified. I'm not saying that because of certain things that were done to Muslim countries justify their reactions. No, I meant to my listeners as well. I don't want to make it seem as though I'm saying, okay, they were right to do what they did. No, I'm just trying to point out.
You're just trying to bring understanding.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. We'll be right back after a quick break.
Are you getting emailed by yourself? Do you find that programs are popping up of their own accord, sometimes not allowing you to do the basic functions you normally do on a program you know so well? Yes, it's time for you to take your computer into Computer Repairs and Solutions. And they're located at 155 Southwest Plaza, Arlington, Texas. Or simply call 817-483-0933 today. Let me repeat, that's 817-483-0933 today.
Are you tired of hearing biased news reports or unfair journalists reporting their own agendas? Tune in.
Do you find others unsympathetic to your understanding?
Yes.
Don't know how to tell it like it is?
Right.
It's time to tune in to
Truth Talk with Myron on BBS Radio every other Saturday at 10 a.m. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.
Still trying to figure out who to listen to? You should tune in to Myron of Truth Talk.
And we're back here at Truth Talk as we talk about the Islamic effect here in America. Now, to pick back up on the issue that we started out with this morning, is that I want to ask this to you, Ms. Farish, is that can we say that, in fact, that in this country that we live in, that racism has not disappeared but changed, such as can we say that race and ethnicity-based racism, going all the way back to the 19th century, has been replaced by cultural-based racism in this century, instead of the country seeing blackness or other qualifications that people were subjected to, it has changed to kind of ethno-cultural identities such as Chinese, Japan, Turks, and others. And what I'm alluding to is Islamophobia. Do you think that this country suffers from that?
Well, I think there is some. I think when people get to once they have a Muslim friend or a Muslim coworker, you know, that they can get to know, they find they're very fond of them, and they, you know, these barriers come down. I think there is some. The unfortunate thing is that Islam pretty much came onto the American radar screen, cultural radar screen. The understanding and awareness of Islam came to our attention in connection with these acts of violence, and we had not paid attention. We had to get on an extremely steep learning curve as Americans, because we just had not paid attention to the Middle East. Americans have had a long-standing interest in Israel, and would go over there as tourists occasionally, or go to Turkey and see historic sites. But, you know, it just had not been the Middle Eastern culture, for example, and Islamic religion had not been something that was a popular field of study in college. Was just a very sleepy area in academia and in the press. And when when Kutba arose in Egypt in the 50s, that wasn't in the press in America. The Marxism that swept North Africa in the 60s and 70s, that was totally just, you know, went right past us. We were totally consumed with our own interests. But, you know, like the the racial the demonstrations, protests, upheavals, and anti-war demonstrations we had, the recurrent revival of interest in Marxism in this country that we had in the 60s and 70s, we thought this was unique to us. It was happening all over the Middle East and North Africa as well. Mm-hmm. And we just were ignorant. We were so insensitive and ignorant to both the cultural and religious differences, because they're not prominent at all in the U.S., and they were not well covered in the media at the time. So when we had Khobar Towers bombing, the USS Cole bombing, all of a sudden we start hearing about Islam and what, and then of course on 9/11, we start hearing about the claims and complaints of certain groups, subgroups in Islam, and it created this association in the national consciousness with violence because of the sequence of events. And that has we've had to really work to overcome that, and I think there has been a lot of careful restraint in a lot of quarters and in education, in schools, to quickly learn about who these people are who celebrate and practice Islam, who Muhammad was, what the Quran is, and what the various cultures are, how it manifests itself in various cultures around the world. It's been very interesting. I have family members who've gone to live in the Middle East, who've learned Arabic because it's important. It's important to know. So I've visited D.C. a few times over the past 10 years, and you just go to Starbucks, you know, just anywhere around, you know, the D.C. area. There are people out with their Arabic textbooks out. You know, we're on a learning curve.
Right.
And that, you know, Americans have been very visible overseas because of our media and because we're just a very exuberant, boisterous culture. But we haven't realized other people are watching that don't understand us, don't understand our freedom of speech, don't understand that everything they see on the media is not what truly represents us. So we've been misunderstood, too, and we didn't account for that either.
Right, right.
And have, you know, really offended many people and done real damage. I'm telling you, Myron, I think we've done as much damage through a lot of our media, exporting pornography, gambling, violent, grotesque, the interest in horror and just gruesomeness now that's in American media. This is very negative, and I don't want people to die physically, but I don't want them to die, you know, in their spirits either. And this is not good. Right. And I think until Americans face the fact that we are doing harm and making money off of it every day, we're going to have a real problem. And I think Muslims overseas legitimately have a problem with America and what we're exporting because of that, as much as they do with, you know, a bomb that went off in the wrong neighborhood, was misdirected, or an American
right.
military who didn't conduct themselves right. Those are very terrible things, but we're doing this other intentionally and making money off of it.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
This threatens their families, and that hits them where they live every day, you know?
Right, right.
And I wish that we understood that better. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a Moroccan official,
mm-hmm.
and I said, you know, sometimes it looks like I wish Muslims would, who are in America, would help us with the culture wars. I wish they would speak up more in this country in appropriate forums about the evils of this society that I know they see.
Right.
Where
right.
are they picketing the abortion clinics? Where are they protesting a new casino being built? Where are they on a gay marriage? We need
right.
some help. Those who
right.
are trying to make this country a wholesome place to be. And the only time we see a Muslim scholar, a Muslim leader on TV or in the media is when they're advocating for themselves and their community, and that's fine. And they need to be vigilant for their own rights. But if they will present themselves in the media as concerned for the larger society and the welfare and the direction of everyone, they will win so many friends so fast. If they will do it, you know, speak in sociological terms and exhibit good faith, good sense, and goodwill for all of us, not just looking out for Muslims, but all of us, they do better. And this Pew survey, the Pew Research Center survey I alluded to in the first half hour, said that Muslim Americans are a little bit below the national average in community service and volunteerism. And it's a great way to make friends and to represent a person's faith or a person's demographic group, to find yourself shoulder to shoulder with someone else, you know, organizing a clothing drive for the community, not just the Muslim community, but for everybody, to serve others, even when they don't agree with you. This is something that Americans historically have done and have valued, and, you know, that is a way that I see that Muslims can go forward and be and win some more hearts and minds. They want to be accepted and thought well of, and that's a good way to do it.
Right. I agree. But do you think that more of them do not speak up out of fear, maybe?
Well, I've looked at, you know, hate crime statistics. I followed those for many years. We're about to have the hate crime statistics for last year. Initial ones come out, usually come out in June, maybe July. But we're not seeing Muslims being victimized particularly in hate crimes in this country. They are actually financially doing as well as everyone else, which isn't that great, but, you know, they said 46% of them say they are in excellent or good shape financially, and only 38% of the general public says that. So okay. Muslims are feeling financially better, a little bit better than most in terms of the numbers of them who report that. And actually they say, 75% roughly say that hard work leads to success. And the general public only, about half of them say that. So, in other words, Muslim Americans believe in the American dream and are convinced that if they just work hard, they will do well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. I'm so glad. I wish more people were convinced that. But I'm so glad that Muslims do have that confidence in their economic freedom and the prospects, promising prospects for themselves and their families in this country. They come here because of that from other countries. But Muslims still are a disproportionately immigrant population. They're pretty much following the trajectory of other immigrants. But I have to say that Muslims tend to be more divergent from the assumptions of American public policy than possibly most other immigrants that we've had, by which I mean there's quite a spread between the public policy of the United States, which is like the kind of consensus or ethos that underlies our laws, and that of Islam as expressed in Sharia and most forms of Islam overseas in terms of the expressions of it in their government. Let me give you six or eight quick examples. I don't want to get too legalistic here, but for example, there are many things that in American public policy that are illegal, that are criminal, or are grounds for divorce that are promoted or justified in Sharia. There are things that are illegal under Sharia that are promoted in American public policy, such as free speech, criticizing authority, questioning authority, and institutional power, the place of the religious majority in a society and government, completely different in American public policy as under Sharia or in Iran or Saudi Arabia, which are come the closest to being actual Muslim governments. The view of forgiveness is different. I'm writing a scholarly article on this between at least the cultural assumptions prevalent in the U.S. and the holy text that Muslims honor. The substantive law is different, like the view of lying, of blasphemy, apostasy, proselytizing, all of those things. They may be criminal in one setting and yet promoted in the other. Equality is a criminal offense in Saudi Arabia for a woman to, drive, for her to go someplace in public without a man escort, for a doctor to treat a woman to touch her body. They have to have women healthcare professionals, although there are people in Saudi that are changing that now, working to change it. The view of domestic violence is quite different. If you look at Surah Which one is that? I'll have to get back to you on that. But the view of what 434, Surah 434, in the Quran, what is permissible in terms of honor killing, forced marriage, female genital mutilation, if those are promoted in some Muslim country, those are all criminal activity here. So we have quite a spread, quite a gap to cross for there to be a comfort level. And we did have 30% of Muslim Americans surveyed said they thought there was a conflict between being a devout Muslim and living in a modern society. And that was about the same in 2007. It was 32%, now it's 31%. But still, that I think Muslims are feeling some difficulty in how am I going to be a devout Muslim? How am I going to listen to my imam from my either my home country or my parents' home country or the imam down the street who may have certain interpretations of Sharia that my government in this country or my culture does not even think is, you know, anything but criminal behavior. We have the Cairo Declaration, which was the statement of all 56 members of the Organization of Islamic States worldwide. All 56 of them signed this Cairo Declaration a few years ago and said all rights and freedoms are subject to the Islamic Sharia. So they don't acknowledge that human rights are inherent in people when they're born or conceived. They don't agree with that. This is
right.
All the members of the Organization of Islamic States.
Right.
And so
right.
We have a big divergence on human rights. It's all subject to Sharia. They will not sign on to the regular UN Declaration on Human Rights because they say it has to be subject to Sharia, has to be subject to the laws of the member states, they say in another place, which again is, you know, Sharia influenced. So
right.
We have some real problems, and there is also legitimacy to asking, is there a phobia among Muslims of Western things? You know, is there a Christophobic, is there a Judeophobic attitude among Muslims, either
well,
in this country or
I wanted to add to that because I think that's where the great divide is, what you bring up and the difference, and I think that's why it has a lot to do with religion and the belief system, basically, at the foundation of it all across the board. Like when you said the things that America, you know, makes money off of that is in conflict to their beliefs, as well as many Christians, it's a conflict. Okay, but to add to what you said, when you brought up the surah, and now you correct me if I'm wrong, you're more of an expert than I am in this, it basically says that men are managers of women, and that if the righteous, if that righteous women are obedient, and that Allah has enjoined them to guard, you know, so to speak, that, you know, for wives who misconduct themselves, I guess you could say, first the man is supposed to advise them, and basically violence, I guess you could say, are a last resort. But basically, if they obey you, then you don't have to seek any course of action against them. Is that correct in summation, kind of, sort of?
Well, yeah, it's more specific than that. There's this a progression of if the woman is disobedient, you can refuse your bed to her. You can, and then the last step is you can beat her, and then there's been some embroidery on that that says you can beat her with a feather, or that the common final step is with a, I can't remember the name of the word, it's like mimquad or something. It's a branch mm-hmm. of a tree. I've actually seen these. They are used as toothbrushes. Mm-hmm. And so it's about the equivalent of beating her with a toothbrush. So that's the tradition that's been added on to the verse. But the surah itself does not say that. It says you can beat her or hit her in Arabic. And again, Arabic is the only language that you really can discuss the Quran. It has to, you know, any translation is not viewed as, you know, inspired by God or anything. But this is, you know, it's not just that, although that's an important one to consider, but it's also the question of the view that a woman, you have to have two witnesses to what a woman says, whereas a testimony of one man mm-hmm. will suffice in a legal proceeding. And these are established understandings of civil procedure in any Islamic court. And, you know, one thing that's interesting to me, Myron, is that there are many places, and a couple there in North Texas, these mediation centers or a domestic arbitration or various things they're called that set themselves up as alternate dispute resolution forums for Muslims, and interestingly, it's almost exclusively in the domestic realm, where the woman has many fewer rights. Child custody is different. It's not the best interest of the child. It goes with the father. The child goes with the father. And the concept that a Muslim woman is never to marry a Muslim man, whereas a Christian man or a non-Muslim, whereas a Muslim man can marry one outside of faith, issues concerning polygamy, although that's kind of a straw man in this country. But these areas of domestic law are actually almost the most divergent of any. The sense that you can kill for adultery. And so yes, it's surprising to me that it's accepted, because the domestic law is quite different.
Yes, ma'am. We're about out of time, and I certainly want to thank you, Ms. Farish, for taking the time to join us today and sharing your expertise.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that, and we want to thank you all for listening. Thank our producers for such a good job that they do, and our engineer, sorry. But until next time, be prayerful, be wise, and be adaptable. God bless you, everyone.
Telling it like it is, no subject is taboo. If it's brought to the table, you bet we cover it. No more lies, no more deception. You have a right to know. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.